Hey everybody, I'm Mike Petriello. We're here for the debut episode of the MLB.com StatCast podcast. We're here to talk about all of the amazing things that we've learned from StatCast over the last couple of months. Here with me is Corey Schwartz, Vice President of Stats for MLB Advanced Media. Corey, welcome.
Good to be here. Thank you, Mike.
How are you doing?
I'm excited. I got a bunch of data printed out and I'm ready to rock.
I can see the sheets and I can't wait to see what you brought us today. So StatCast, you know, we first saw this last fall, right? We saw a couple of sparse videos here and there for video, or for defense mostly. And now this season, we've got data on just about everything. So I was hoping you could talk to us a little bit about how we got to this point. Like, how did we go from nothing at all publicly to what we're seeing now, which is almost an avalanche of numbers?
It's a long story. I'll try and sum it up. It really goes back to 2001, the early days of MLB.com. We knew we wanted to implement tracking technology in baseball right away. We had seen it in some other sports a little bit. It had been done a little bit in baseball, but we really wanted to sort of come up with a league-wide system. But the challenge is, based on the nature of what we do here at MLB.com, it needed to be real-time so we could use it in our products and get it to fans in a way that related to the game. And it needed to be something that we could scale out across all 30 ballparks rather than just a game here and there. And frankly, it took some time for that to happen. MLB.com started in 2001, but our first application of PitchFX wasn't until the 2006 postseason. It really took that long to get it going. And then PitchFX gradually built up, and it's now something that we're used to seeing with every single game. Shortly after that launch, though, in 06, we really started looking for a way to expand that out to include all the plays. But again, we needed to find the right technology. We needed to find a solution that was detailed, accurate, robust, and could perform in real time, which is a very different challenge for tracking players than it is just for tracking the pitch. The pitch moves in a very finite space in very predictable ways. The players and fielders and batters and base runners and the ball, all those things move around all over the place. So it took a while to get it up and running. It really hit the really memorable moment for me was in the fall of 2012. We started working with a company called Chiron Higo, who's now our partner in this endeavor. They do a lot of tracking in European League football, which we call soccer here in the States. They did a sample, sort of a few test games out in Scottsdale and Arizona Fall League, and they came back and showed us some of their sample data. I remember it was in November of 2012, and those of us in the room just sort of sat back in our chairs, and our jaws went down, and the light bulbs went up all throughout the room over our heads, and we knew that we were really going to be able to do something with this company and with this technology. So that was when it really started in earnest, and we started to roll out a testing system last year in 3 venues, and now we're up to 30 ballparks, and that's sort of the long story, hopefully relatively short.
Well, so the partner you just named, I think that's not a name that people know too much about. Maybe people are more familiar with TrackMan, for example.
Right. So TrackMan is a Danish company. They're actually very active in golf before they got involved in baseball because the mechanics of the golf swing are very similar to the baseball swing. You're swinging a club at a ball, and the ball has an exit velocity and spin and so forth. So TrackMan really started out in golf and then moved into baseball over the last several years. Chiron Higo, if you've ever watched a broadcast of anything on TV, and there's a little graphic at the bottom of the screen, they commonly call that a Chiron. That's sort of, they are the Kleenex, if you will, or the Coke, you know, the Coca-Cola, of what they do, which is creating broadcast graphics. And Higo was the company that was building the tracking technology. So Chiron acquired Higo, and they became Chiron Higo, and really built out that tracking technology in a way that we can use now in baseball. So it's an endeavor. Between those two vendors and BAM, it's their technology, and we ramp it out to the field, and we operate it, and able to capture all that data.
So how does this work? I mean, I know people think it's radar, right? But obviously, there's a lot more to it than that. It's in each of the 30 ballparks this year. You know, how did you go about the process of installing it? How long did it take?
Again, this started last season. We were in 3 ballparks, and then in the fall, really, we started to ramp it out to all 30. We started with the club ballparks that were in the postseason last year. And then over the winter, we filled out the rest of the 30 ballparks, and our multimedia engineering department that doesn't get a lot of love on podcasts and so forth, they were all around the country. They were in 3 or 4 or 5 ballparks every week throughout January and February and March installing hardware. But that was really what was the important part of last year, was building the system that could operate in the 3 ballparks. And then you spend the offseason dealing with all the unique physical characteristics of each ballpark to find out where to hang the radar pads, where to install the cameras, where to run all the cabling that needs to go on, where to put a room for the operators to run the technology. And then ultimately, once you start tracking games, that's when you see the unique environmental factors. So some ballparks have a lot of glare from the sun. That'll affect the tracking cameras. Some of them have a lot of shadows. there are different aspects in different in each ballpark that you have to sort of burn in, so to speak. So the first couple of weeks, that was really what that was about. But now that the system is fully up and running, we're really starting to see, no system is perfect, but the data that comes out of this system is unbelievable. And it's really been a lot of fun to start to scratch the surface of what we might learn.
Yeah, so it's been a couple months of data now. And, you know, for me, I know what surprised me is I really thought that the first thing that was going to come to mind was, oh, this defense is great. The defense stats are cool, but it's really been the pitching data that's really been interesting to me, the velocity and the rotation. What stood out to you that's been really more than you expected it might be?
Well, it's actually has a lot to do with home runs. You know, that's something that all fans appreciate is a really, you know, just a crushed home run that goes into the upper deck, and we see all these measurements that are put out there. But it's been interesting to me looking at the home run data that there seems to be a practical limit for how far a person can hit a ball and how many balls cluster sort of just below that. You know, we always used to think of, you know, a 450-foot home run as being just an utter bomb. And it is, but a lot of guys hit 450-foot home runs. I mean, we've seen a few dozen of those this year. But you don't see a lot of the 330, 340, 350 types that just get over the fence, because the way we're measuring it is what we call flat carry. If the ball strikes an object, you know, on the way, whether it's the upper deck or a fan's glove in the stands or whatever it may be, that's not the end point to us. We're measuring to where the ball would have gone had it landed at field level. So the distances we're seeing are actually a little bit further in some cases than you might think, because we're measuring it back out to ground level, not just where it hit the stands or a glove or whatever.
Right. And I think it's been interesting that there are different ways to now evaluate home runs, because it used to just be how far did it go, right? But now it could be if a home run didn't necessarily go that far, but if, say, Giancarlo Stanton hit it on a line at a million miles an hour, that's almost as or more impressive.
Yeah, and, you know, there's definitely a sweet spot where a velocity and launch angle, which is, you know, the vertical angle off field level, where a ball is going to be a home run. You know, if you're hitting 195, 100 miles an hour or more, and 20, 30, 35 degrees in that range, that's a home run, you know, almost 100% of the time. But there's an angle where it's too high, where it becomes a high fly ball or a pop-up. And if the angle is too low, no matter how hard you hit it, it's going to be a line, you know, it's going to be a line drive that might go through for a double or a single, or it might find a glove. I was watching a Red Sox game a couple weeks ago, and Mookie Betts hit one, I don't remember the exact number, but I think it was 110 miles an hour, and he hit it right at the third baseman. So the launch angle was probably just a few degrees above field level. And then an inning later, Mike Napoli hit one the same exact velocity, you know, rounding to the whole number, but at a launch angle of like 35 degrees, and it cleared the Green Monster. That really shows that, you know, hitting a ball hard is important. Hitting the ball at the right angle is important, but you have to put both of them together to get the home run.
And it really is a move away almost from outcome-based analysis, right? It's about what
Absolutely.
Did you do, not necessarily did the fielder happen to be standing in the right spot or not.
Absolutely. I think, you know, long-term, particularly as it relates to fielding, we do want to get away from outcomes. You know, so much of data measurement right now, despite everybody's best attempts, it's not a criticism of anybody, but we only have the result data. We know it was a double or a home run or a line out, or the fielder caught the ball or the fielder didn't catch the ball. What we really want to do as the system builds out and as we get more and more data and learn what it means is measure skills and then see how those skills equate to results. So when a guy hits a ball 110 miles an hour on a 5-degree launch angle, we can say 75% of the time that's a hit. He just got robbed, you know, bad luck or good defensive player, whatever it may be. And I think this will apply really well to fielding as well. Think of, for example, an outfielder making a running attempt at a fly ball and he dives and it just misses it. That goes down as a double in the scorebook or a triple or whatever it may be. But the outfielder may have exhibited tremendous skill just in getting close to the ball. Think of an outfielder who chases a fly ball, you know, chases what would be home run and leaps at the fence and the ball just cleared his glove. We may discover that that was a more exceptional play than an outfielder who makes a catch in some cases because of the skill that player had to exert just to get close to that ball and make the catch.
Right, and I really do think the big changes it's going to have on defense is starting position.
Oh, yeah.
So over the winter, I worked with a National League outfielder who didn't understand why the defensive metrics didn't like him. And he thought he was a good outfielder. Nobody else really did.
Don't name names now.
No, certainly not. But I explained to him how the advanced stats work, and he, you know, hadn't quite understood it. And then he's like, well, it doesn't account for where I start. My team shades me over this way, and then the ball goes that way. And I think that's really going to make a big difference because we never really had that before.
Right. You know, I think starting position is critically important. I think the hang time of batted balls is critically important. We were having this conversation with Chris Dial, who's sort of a leader in the, you know, in the analytic community in developing fielding stats. And we were talking about range. How do you define range? You know, we're trying to take baseball terminology that we've used since we were kids and create metrics around these things so it'll be understandable. And Chris made a really good point. He said, if every batted ball had unlimited hang time, then every fielder would have unlimited range, because eventually you would get there. So we realized how important hang time is in evaluating the performance of outfielders, in particular chasing down fly balls. And eventually, just like with home runs, we'll find that sweet spot where if the hang time is this, unless it's hit right at you, you're not getting it. But if the hang time is this, I don't care where you start, you better get it.
Right. And you know what's cool about it is teams are using this.
Yes.
We already know this. And that's one of the main questions people ask when they first hear about it, is like, these numbers are cool, but you know, so what? What do they mean? And we know that teams are using this. Famous example right now is Colin McHugh with the Astros. Mm-hmm. Didn't do much with the Mets, didn't do much with Colorado. Houston went after him, I think, just on a waiver claim because they liked the spin rate on his curveball, and he's been a very big success for them. And I'm sure they're not the only team that is selecting guys based on that.
Absolutely. You know, the batted ball data and some of the spin data that TrackMan produces has been available to the clubs for a few years, and those clubs might not be happy about it, but we think there's tremendous fan-based interest in this data as well. But one of the things that's enjoyable for me in my position is that I get to deal with all 30 clubs to some extent or another. And I generally find that if you give the same data set to 30 clubs, they'll all do 30 different things with it. Think about catcher framing, which has really become a very prominent analytic topic and sabermetric topic over the last few years. I know for a fact there were clubs looking at this 5 or 6 or 7 years ago, but they were doing it very quietly and the research wasn't quite in the public domain yet, so no one was really talking about it. There's a club that we worked with back in 02 and 03 that nobody thinks of as a sabermetric club by any stretch of the imagination. They were the first club to receive fielding position data from BAM, just that we're creating from our stringers, and looking at that and using it to develop spray charts. So every club will value the information differently and try and do different things with it.
Yeah, I mean, I look at this, there's like 15 different things that haven't done yet that I really want to do. Like, it measures catcher pop times, which I think is phenomenal. You know, it measures outfield throwing arm velocity. Like, who's got a stronger arm, Cespedes or Puig? It's kind of just anecdotal at the moment, but I mean, that's something we're going to be able to measure and come up with leaderboards and see how it correlates year over year and all this.
And those are really two good terms you use there, because we're trying to create metrics, as I said, that are understandable. So, for example, when you go sit in the stands at the ballpark, you say that outfielder got a great jump or that shortstop has a great arm. We're not trying to reinvent the wheel here. We're trying to quantify things in a way that hasn't been possible before and help people relate to why certain players do certain things better than other players. What does it mean? What is it worth? And how do we compare them? And understand, and one thing I'm really exciting about is getting away from the notion of, this guy's a great shortstop and this guy's a terrible shortstop. You know, here in New York, both of those things were said about Derek Jeter, often in the same sentence. But I think the truth is probably somewhere in between. I think some players do certain things exceptionally well and other things maybe not as well. And every team is a collection of 25 players, at any given moment at least, and those players have assorted strengths and weaknesses. And the challenge for the front office and the manager is to assemble a team where the strengths and weaknesses of each player complement each other, so you have a strong team. So if you have a shortstop who doesn't have great range, you might accommodate for that with different positioning, or your pitchers might pitch a different way, or you might ask that fielder to do something different than the shortstop would do on a different team.
And we're going to be able to quantify that in an entirely different way. I mean, you might be able to say next year, Brandon Crawford averaged 15 feet for ground balls, or he got to 20 different balls that required 20 feet to get to. That's something we've never really been able to do before.
Right. And then once you have the data, you can turn right around and go back to saying the things we've been saying. For example, we say Jose Altuve is a really good hitter because we have batting average to tell us. So eventually or Giancarlo Stanton has great power because we have his home run totals to tell us. Eventually we'll have metrics where we can say this guy's the best in the game at going to his left, because we'll be able to quantify that. We won't say, his lateral range within this vector is X degrees. We won't talk about that. We'll talk about this guy has great range. Just like right now, we say this guy's got a great slider. We don't talk about the velocity and the spin rate and all those things. We know a good slider when we see it. We'll just have some numbers now to back that up a little bit more.
And what I'm really hoping we're going to be able to do is feed this back into pitch classification. Mm-hmm. Because PitchFX has done a very good job for an automated system, but it's not perfect. You know, sometimes it misclassifies this and that. But now that we can really see the spin rate, you can already see that they group into buckets for different pitches.
You know, I've been working on the pitch classifications for quite a while, so thank you for saying it's pretty good. I think it's pretty good. But you're right. You know, the challenge is that pitches exist along a spectrum. Many pitchers, for example, will throw a two-seamer or a sinker, if you prefer, a four-seamer and a cutter. They'll throw a slider, they'll throw a curveball, and these are variations on very similar themes. So some pitchers, it's hard to tell apart the slider and the curveball sometimes. You might call it a slurve, but it might be two separate pitches. Some guys throw a cutter and a slider. Those pitches look similar. The four-seamer can look like the cutter. And then you have to deal with the problem of what does the pitcher call it? So I've dealt with some of these things, and I try and research it and call the pitch what the pitcher calls it. There's some guys who throw what looks like from the data you would call a cutter because of the movement. But then you ask the pitcher, he says, no, I've never thrown a cutter in my life. I throw a four-seamer. Okay, we call it a four-seamer. Then another guy insists that his primary pitch is a cutter, but you look at the data, it's a four-seamer. So, right. You know, there's always this sort of balance between what does the data tell you and what does the player want to tell you. There's a little bit of subjectivity in that. But the nice thing about it is when you're measuring a batted ball, the guy can say, I really smoked that. But you know what, if you hit it 98 miles an hour, nah, you know, that's okay, but it's not great.
So what do you think is next? What's the next step for us now that we've got all this out there?
Oh, wow. Well, you know, from a product and a fan-facing standpoint, we really want to start to build an interface for this where people can look at the stats and look at the data. Right now, we have everything in game day and at bat, you know, on your iPhone and on your computer where you can see a lot of the batted ball data, particularly on home runs. But we really want to basically build out a stats section with the new data we have. And then we need to keep working. We're working with two consultants, data scientists from NYU here in New York, who are really helping us build out these measures and metrics. Again, we're not trying to throw everything into the kitchen sink and create a magic number and say this is the best player in the land. We're trying to evaluate the different skills in different ways but in ways that people will understand. So our goal is really to start looking into that data, figuring out what is a sufficient sample size where it becomes meaningful, polishing off some of the rough edges, and then presenting it out there so fans can start to settle or maybe start some new arguments. Well, this guy's better to his left, but going to the right is more important. You know, that our CEO, Bob Bowman, likes to say, we're not going to solve arguments, we're going to create more arguments. And I think that'll be a lot of fun because baseball fans like to debate this stuff.
It's a pretty exciting time to be watching baseball, isn't it?
It is. You know, I am first and foremost a baseball fan, and I pinch myself once every couple of days and say, this is just so cool.
It's amazing.
This is just so cool.
Corey, great stuff. Thanks for taking the time.
My pleasure. Great to talk to you, Mike.
We are honored to have here with us today on the phone, Zach Day, former Major League pitcher. Zach was a fifth-round pick by the Yankees in 1996. He pitched parts of five seasons with the Expos, Rockies, and Nationals. And since 2008, he's been working with TrackMan, mostly in business development and as a pitching coordinator. Zach, how are you doing today?
I'm great, Mike. Great.
Thanks for joining
us. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. It's very exciting times now. I know you've been with TrackMan for a while, and you know finally this information can be out in the public sphere, and you can talk a little more freely about what you do with your days.
Yeah, it's been quiet, I'd say, since 08 and just the introduction. And the information was and still is being held pretty tight. But we're starting to see a glimpse of that, which is fantastic. And I'm excited because I've been talking about some of the numbers with teams and with people for a while now. And now I think it's going to be able to be out in the public a little bit more, which is really exciting.
So I'd be interested to know how you transitioned from being a pro ball player to getting to TrackMan. I know you said you started there in 2008, and I think that was also the last season you pitched in pro ball. So it sounds like the transition was pretty quick.
It was a week.
A week.
literally a week. And I don't think TrackMan knew that I was fully. Or it had only been a week, but John called me up. After a couple of injuries, I'd stopped and. A week after I'd stopped, I'd worked with the Players Trust and been involved in there. And John called me up and asked if I was, they knew that I would stop playing and asked if I would come on board and really kind of get into this information. It was information that I hadn't used during my career, but I was very interested in, and I knew the potential that it had. Yeah, it was literally all new for me. So I was excited and welcomed the opportunity.
So did you have any kind of background in technology, or maybe even I should ask, had you ever had an office job before working at TrackMan?
No, I hadn't. my baseball was a career baseball. I signed out of high school, so. When John approached me, I had no experience in a technology background. Technology background, regardless, I think it's more from my standpoint is how well you can visualize and see the numbers and put them to life and kind of visually make the numbers. Bring something out of the numbers that's what I hopefully grasped and I was able to take on. I since after, you know, while I was Well, I was working at TrackMan, and I finished up my bachelor's degree in business. But yeah, that was it. Definitely was an initial, as is for most, an initial shock as far as getting into the real world after baseball. But I was looking forward to it.
So tell us a little bit more about the kind of the day-to-day of the company, about John, who you mentioned, about how you worked with him, and you know what your primary role is there on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, so John's a GM at TrackMan. John brought me on board, like you mentioned, in 2008. And, initially we go around the teams and show them the technology, show them what we could do, and just trying to get buy-in. And that was my initial role, was as a kind of to bridge the gap, because we'd set up on field, we'd set up bullpens and just sit up and just talk about the data. And the learning curve involved, and just trying to understand the data, what the potential could be, and really just also work with John, and it was John and myself, and then we had somebody come on board that would help kind of also interpret the data. So we kind of throw thoughts around and start to see the data come to life in different areas and the values that it could have. But It was an exciting first few years of trying to get it. It was trying to just get people to believe, just get teams to believe that this data was is valuable and had a big value, a big potential.
Well, that's an interesting question, because I think with the advent of or the increase in advanced stats usage over the last couple of years, there's been a lot of players who've been very famously against kind of the new wave of stats. And how have you found the reception from active players when you started talking to them about spin rate and batted ball velocity and all the stuff you're measuring here?
We don't. It's a very good question. So I've talked to. It's also a very wide range of from I've never heard of it to I'm very interested in it, and I can't get enough of it. So there's definitely a range, and obviously there's the in between, but. And the same goes with the coaching staff. It's old school, new school, battle, the clash, of, I can see these things with my eyes, or I know that, I can see this, I can see what's going on the field. I don't need this technology compared to, give me data. I can't necessarily see everything. And also I want to have record of this data over a longer period of time to be able to make decisions and a bunch of other stuff. So yeah, it was it still is kind of a clash between the two.
Sure. Well, I can't imagine how much you've learned about the art of pitching and measurement working at TrackMan. So let's say tomorrow you were back on a major league mound, knowing what you know now, how would you approach your game differently?
So that's a great question. I was a sinker ball guy, big sinker, big ground ball, fly ball ratio, huge. And I didn't have my TrackMan data, didn't have data, spin rate data. I didn't have the tilt, which is direction the ball spinning, release height, all that information that goes into, ground ball, fly ball ratio. But if I were to look at it again, I would definitely understand my strengths, which is ground ball, and my certain numbers or data of why this got me there. And then I would take those strengths and I would work, create a foul. Basically, I would take the sinker and I would create a pitch off of that, my strengths. I can better know my strengths, which I knew it was a sinker, but I could say, all right, going based off of my sinker, my data on my sinker, I need to learn this. Which probably would have been, I need to learn the ball. I need to learn how to throw the ball straighter. So, based off of that information, I can make the ball sink and I can make the ball move. But my weakness was keeping it straight.
Well, I think what we've learned, sticking with fastballs for a moment, it's good to have a low spin rate, or it's good to have a high spin rate, right? Because you get grounders or you get strikeouts. It's not great to kind of be in the middle. So
yes.
Do you think that, is that a born skill or is it a taught skill? Like if you had a minor leaguer come to you and say, this isn't working for me, I need to change my spin rate, is that something you think, okay, this can be taught?
It's a great question. Can it be taught? I believe you can teach. I believe The question is more of, can you teach it without changing too much? I think that that's the better, the bigger question. I would say I think we can. we've had a very, you know, I haven't worked with it for a little while. I've seen and utilized it in ways that I believe. But with that being said, without scientific proof that this is, you know, this definitely is, you can increase it by doing X, Y, or Z. It's still, you know, it's still just a theory.
Well, a theory we've had here internally that we haven't found a good example of a game yet, but we want to, is whether this changes as a game goes on, like whether fatigue plays a role. Like, for example, could we find a guy who was blowing through seven innings and then get lit up in the eighth? Could we have seen that his spin rate was starting to, you know, lose or increase depending on the guy, you know, in the pitches leading up to that? So did you ever, I know you didn't have the actual data when you were pitching, but did you ever feel that that was something that would change with you as you got more tired?
Yeah, but there's two things I think is going to, and I've told this, and when I talk in the teams, I think this is a very big, I think it's a huge thing as far as being able to tell when a pitcher's done. TrackMan can provide that data over a long period of time. You can pitch counts. You know, pitch counts are a big thing, right? So if you can tell whether it's spin rate, whether it's release height, whether it's these certain data points, they're decreasing after the seventh inning or after a certain amount of pitches every time. Pitch counts is going to be a little bit more. You're going to take the guesswork out. So I think that that's going to be looked at even closer. Some guys might have 80 pitches. Some guys might have 120 pitches in the tank before they see a decrease in whether it's spin, release height, certain data points. Hopefully that'll affect not only performance but also the potential for injury as well.
So one thing it's always been a little fascinating is how different pitchers perform in different environments. And you pitched briefly for the Rockies. You only got into a couple of games at Coors Field, but
yeah.
And obviously, they picked you up because you were a sinker baller. Have you noticed that spin rate is different at altitude or in other environments?
Yeah, that has been definitely. I believe that has been proven that spin, and I'll have to go back and find out what the percentage is. But yeah, spin rate is affected. There's no question as far as different altitude goes. Spin rate will be affected a certain percentage, and it will be a Coors Field. And why certain pitches are harder to throw there than others. It is. You will see more detailed information as far as regarding Coors Field and the data and spin and break and those kind of parameters, but altitude does play a role as well as a couple other factors. But
right,
altitude does.
So. Yeah, we're trying not to draw too many conclusions based on the 2 months of data we have here, but yeah. That's definitely something that's kind of top of the list, especially as the Rockies are just desperate to find pitching, you know, anywhere they can.
Yeah, it's a matter of I go about it. There's a couple things that I think about. And well, one was actually just came up the other day. Was the other thing is when you move a starter to the bullpen, does his spin rate increase? Obviously his velo, sometimes the velo jumps up, but does the spin rate increase as well? So
that's a great question.
Is there a jump? Yeah, is there a jump from a starter going to reliever? Does that play a role in the success if you see that? So there's a lot. There's some great stuff that question wise that we hope to dive into. And I think the altitude will also play a role as well. And just like you said, 2 months worth of data, but you'll start to see some things start to come together.
Zach, last question for you. The different measurements that TrackMan has, which is the one that you personally feel is the most interesting for the common fan to be able to latch onto?
I think right now to start, it's from pitching, it's spin. Just because it's the value of spin is it's an unknown. It's important. Spin makes the ball break. Spin will show some strengths and some weaknesses with certain pitchers that we haven't been able to see before. It'll be grouped in, I think, with velocity. I think you'll find it. People will talk about it as just as I find myself talking about it as much as velocity. I'd rather, you know, when you get, and I don't know what the number is, but when you get to over a certain, a velo over a certain, you know, 97, you're going to get guys out because of velocity. If you're pitching in the average, you're 92, it's a little bit different, right? Your spin is going to play a bigger role than somebody throwing probably 97, 98. So you're going to be talking in terms of spin. I think that it's a fairly easy, of all the numbers that we give, it's a fairly easy number to grasp on. And what we'd be interested in is when we get into not only spin, there's no wasted spin in a fastball or changeup, but there is wasted spin on a breaking ball. So, well, that's just a little glimpse of what we have to look forward to on the spin.
I think you're absolutely right, because spin rate is definitely what's kind of jumped out the most to us as we're trying to write and analyze this. Zach, great stuff here. Thanks so much for your time.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Do it again.
Zach Day, a former big league pitcher, business development with TrackMan. I am Mike Petriello. Thanks to listening to the inaugural MLB.com StatCast podcast. See you next time.